waterway which snakes through schools, neighborhoods, parks, country clubs, all through North County before dumping into the Missouri River just above the confluence and just above St. Louis City's water intake. There are a few other industrial sites marking that, and over the years of exposure, the particles in that dust blew all across North County. Much of this was simultaneous to the development of the northern suburbs, so you had a combination of loose particulate matter, construction dust kickup. By some arguments, it is really just folded into the landscape of all of North County. It's worth noting, too, that Coldwater Creek demarcates a kind of boundary between Black St. Louis County and a residual white and integrated St. Louis County, northern St. Louis County, right? Northern St. Louis County saw a remarkable influx of Black population from the city and a second generation white outflux to further suburbs. One question that comes up very often in this moment as that progresses in communities like Hazelwood is whether or not the risks associated with this contamination actually get transmitted through any of the sort of real estate systems, right? Mm. Like the resale of land that allows people to move to St. Charles is propped up on the desirability of that land. And so that's to invoke a number of points and a number of political, economic, ecological landscapes. But in terms of Westlake itself, Eric has spent more time here than me.
Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, so a number of different ways maybe we could talk about where we are. Let me preface it with, there's a geographer named Doreen Massey. She wrote a book called Four Space. And it's one of the, you know, I kind of have, for me to experience and understand a place, I kind of have to attach myself to a concept. And one of the concepts she talks about is, knowledge. How do we shift something from what we know intellectually to something that we can know experientially? And then what that translates into in terms of ethics and responsibility and a change of behavior. And so she says this thing. She says, we know the earth is spinning underneath of us, right? We all know that we learn that, but how do we feel what we know? So how do you feel that? How do you take that knowledge that you learn and how do you feel it? And one of the things that this site does, and this is kind of the beginning of the conversations that I've been having now for a couple of years with a group of activists they call themselves Just Moms. This is a group that's been around for about 8 or 9 years. These are two mothers from the community, and they are just moms because they're talking about justice and just and justice, but they're also talking about they were thrown into this role merely by being the circumstances of living in these neighborhoods and having to reconcile not necessarily the risk of the waste, but the perception of the risk of the waste and how the perception also translates into health factors, fear factors. And it gets very complex at that point because you start to have conversations around the actual toxicity and radioactivity that exists in the site versus the perceived risk of the site. And both of these influence the health factors that get quantified and how resources are moved. But to back out, what this means for them is every morning they get up, and I'm sort of the community. There's about 1,000, a little over 1,000 members of this group, Just Moms group, and they meet in the church, and they've been meeting for 7 years, and I have received a grant to help bring my students, and we teach here, and we have a kind of collaboration. We go to these meetings with them, and it's really remarkable. This has been a site that, with a history that I'm just not, it's too complex to go into in any detail, but one of the things that we started out that I found remarkable is that the relationship on a daily basis with where they live it starts with their nose. So they get out of the house and they smell the air. So, you know, you're lighting the incense, and we're all now aware of a different change of our environment and what we're smelling. So, you know, but that is making the invisibility of the things that are here, giving them a kind of tangibility. So, you know, if you go back to limestone caving and the sort of formations where we are, a lot of times caves were discovered because of the cold air that's coming through. So you could actually start to understand where you were, not with your eyes, but by the tactile sense of the temperature change. And so larger caves you'd be able to see from or feel from much further away. So they understand where they're from by kind of smelling their place. And the perception of, is it safe to go outside today, is it not? And so that essentially all hold, this is a kind of an anchor that starts to spread out in 1 mile radiuses that legally translates into boundaries of buyouts and relocations. And right now there has been a 1 mile relocation around where we are, and they're trying to make a second one go through a buyout right now. But what we're in front of, what we're on to, so if we take the kind of the phenomenal aspects of where we are, the smells, the taste, how do we see this? And of course we can hear it. We can hear the release of the gases and the methane and the compression of the fill. We don't see necessarily as an underground smoldering event. It's not a fire, it's an event. If it's a fire legally, then there's different groups that are responsible for it if it's a fire, but if it's an event, that is ambiguous. Republic Services is the company that's responsible for this. This is half, 40% of this is owned by Bill Gates. It's an entanglement of public utilities with waste remediation, with very large budgets that are coming from the EPA, because essentially this moved into a Superfund site right away, but it moved to the top of the list because of there's Manhattan, the waste that's here is also related to the Manhattan Project. And the perception then that you can't ever, you're in a kind of history that's not past, and it's kind of exploding or slowly detonating in the ground around us. And the reinvestment by current administrations in nuclear programs, not for energy, but for weaponry. And the association that we're sort of, we are on a historical site that is also a matter of pride from a lot of Americans' point of view. World War II, you know, what we're seeing, what's buried here is the thing that allowed us to win the war in a way, right? The production of uranium and things like this. And so the image and the perception of what the government was interested in, as I understand it, is a perception of victory and power and a military responsibility. And then we take it and we sort of see the externalities and the consequences of what we live in and what that power translates in for a very local government. I mean, a very local community that, and this gets very, you know, it has very high proportions of cancer kinds of cancer that are, you can easily draw a line to the source and the cause. And the difficulty in translating scientific evidence to psychological evidence of the perception of this risk. Sorry, I'm kind of moving around this a little bit, but I'm trying to get to what is maybe very interesting. So we could look at this a couple of ways. If you were to look at the trees around here, anytime there's standing water around the trees, the trunk, where the trunk emerges, it hits the ground, that root cap, any water forming is where the most toxic waste is kind of leaching and coming up to the surface. You'll see little fissures if we go into this parking lot, or if you look at the ground, and if there's standing water from a storm, there'll be little gas bubbles that are coming up through the cracks, and you can actually see and hear and smell some of the things that are around us differently. But essentially what this activist group has is a kind of tiger on a leash. And they have to be non-political, and at the same time that's impossible to extricate yourself from, because the changes of administration equal loss of resources, equal loss of buyouts and funding for the community. So it's a very delicate kind of nimble negotiation between something that, how do you articulate a social injustice, an environmental injustice, and at the same time demand maybe not accountability to the groups that caused it, but mm-hmm. rather response to the people affected by it now. And you have to go through any administration and to make those things happen. So they can't really align themselves for or against particular politicians or parties, but they have this tiger, and so everyone is afraid of when they're going to cut the, you know, do we cut the leash and let it kind of pounce on something? And their power is, because we have these discussions, we're part of Washington University, some of us in this group. This is the collusion between these universities and the military-industrial education complex is profound, and there's Reinhold Martin starts to write about this. He's the chair of theory at Columbia University. And he writes about this through MIT and some of these, the complex in World War II, decentralized cities in America, from some of these examples. But what we're in now is, I meet with scientists at WashU that have things like teeth collections
where the radioactive, the food in the radio, the radioactivity in the food and in the agriculture starts showing up in the molars and the people, and so the teeth themselves become radioactive. So you have these weird artifacts that can unpack almost like the history of the site in a in the ecology of how these things show up as markers and indexes in our bodies. And the body becomes the registration of the environment, and you're not just in a place, the place is in you. And these kind of perceptions almost have to be reframed and reperceived. But essentially, what I find very interesting about this is that we've been meeting, there's a group here called the Community Foundation. They basically leverage a lot of tax-donated gifts in the amounts of millions and millions of dollars from very wealthy people, and say, you decide where the money goes and how it gets allocated. And there was a $14 million allocation to projects in the West Lake or in the community around four projects that they want to support that all deal with public health. And part of the power of Just Moms is we need the fear factor. Our power, you're going to forget about us, and we're not going to have the power of negotiation with the levels of power in. And these are groups that meet with their senators and mayors and governors on a regular basis, and they're in D.C. on a regular basis, kind of advocating for their communities, the realities and rights, and the need to hold on to fear as a mechanism for change, which is very different than I think. You know, I mean, there have been biennales in Berlin, a few biennales ago, where like, you know, against fear, you know, the fear, you know, what is it, a politics and a democracy without fear? Well, here fear becomes an instrument rather than a weapon, a tool that if once it's gone, you lose the ability to have a platform. And so it's a very interesting, so we've been talking about building a marker here, and traditionally, so the marker system, so all of this is going to be removed, or 70% of it, and they're going to dig down to a certain layer, and they're going to remove this and cart it off, and this is very problematic. There's a fantastic book about how problematic this gets called About a Mountain. Mm-hmm. It's written by a guy named John DeGatta, who started a program at Iowa a few years ago on creative nonfiction. But essentially, you know, how do you get this here, and how do you get it out, and suddenly you expose again an entire population to the, you aerate the things that are toxic, and the, you know, so nobody wants it moving through, but nobody wants it here, and so how do you, you know, you're kind of in these multiple catch-22 situations. And essentially what happens is that this becomes a little bit like the suburb that Gavin just kind of choreographed, that drive through. I mean, what do you, you can be exposed to radioactivity for a certain amount of time without it affecting your body in harmful ways. And so there's these buyouts that are attempting to happen now, but essentially what would, if this was following a kind of marker system, now the marker system is the memorial or monument that gets capped, and it corresponds to the burial, where the burial is, and this is all supposed to go to a deep repository in Nevada. It's a waste isolation pilot plant, and there's problems about this now. That's where a lot of the American waste goes in the U.S., the high-grade radioactive waste. But so how it gets from here to there, or how it gets from here to somewhere, and then how do you mark the site that was here with the stories of the people's lives who were affected by what we're in front of? So we're kind of in an active conversation in something that is both something that organizes an identity of a community, but something that the community doesn't necessarily want to be the anchor around which their identity is organized. And maybe we'll come across this in the next couple of days too with some of the Monsanto town sites. I was just talking to Jen a little bit about this. So we're half of what we're in is just trying to understand how to perceive where we are and then reflect those perceptions in a way that they become tools and instruments for change right here, but also in a global sense, because no country has really figured this out. Finland's working on it, some France is working on it some, but this is a global example of something that exists everywhere. And these sites are essentially everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Good, thank you. Just to add, I realized just two very firm sort of clarifying details to spell out exactly what's happening, and it can be a very nerve-wracking space to be in. Right? So this is two adjacent landfills. The one that we are looking at is the Bridgeton landfill, and directly next to it, that way, is the Westlake landfill, The Westlake landfill contains illegally dumped radioactive material, which should have gone to Weldon Springs. The Bridgeton landfill ostensibly does not, but does contain this underground smolder event. Effectively, a fire with no oxygen that is burning towards the nuclear waste.
They can't build firewalls because it's not something you can intervene in.
So a lot of the interventions that Just Moms have been making are around awareness and demands for that, which recently did lead to just a recently won plan for the EPA to remove material, but only 70% of it. It's almost physically impossible to remove all of it. So it's an incredibly contested site, and also in St. Louis's sort of ecological imaginary, I mean, like, this is the nightmare. It haunts people because the narrative that it produces of the fire burning to the radioactive waste, I mean, it's a B movie, right?
So the community here gets packages with, like, here's what to do when you have to bunker in place. Mm-hmm. Here's what you have to do if the event happens. And so you're, the kids don't, for instance, the mothers that I meet with, their children don't ride bikes outside. They don't garden. They don't have their hands in the earth. They don't have a relationship that we kind of take for granted in a daily way with just being outside and feeling safe in the environment that we're in.
So maybe that is a lot, and it is hard to move from sites like this. I think we could invite maybe one or two vocalizations here, whether that's a question or a comment. We're going to stay very close by, though, for lunch, so that sort of everything we've done this morning can play out in co-presence and dialogue. But would anyone like to speak or question here?
I'm just making observation because since I live in the area, I'm really aware of this and the potentiality for creating a nuclear event to occur is a real deal thing. But from indigenous perspective, this is an incense, by the way. There are four herbs that were given pretty much predominantly to the tribe that are considered sacred. So you've got asema, which you refer to as tobacco, then there's sage and sweetgrass and cedar. So you've been seeing me burning these everywhere we go. I also, when I stop, I have some tobacco and I put prayers for healing for not only the land that we're on, but for everybody who's here that wants to lend toward healing. When you see me put the tobacco down, that's what's going on. What I found interesting that I didn't know about in Weldon Springs, that it was prohibited if I wanted to give any of you tobacco. So tobacco, you know, the giving of tobacco and tobacco products is outlawed in Weldon Springs. I'm not quite sure where they derive that from. But I'm finding it very interesting because generally sage is given to not only cleanse the energy of an area, but to acknowledge to the ancestors that you come in a good way, you're coming in an honorable way. And the burning, the way the sage burns will sometimes let you know about the energy in the area. So since I stepped off the bus and lit this one, it's gone. So the sage that was here has been wholly utilized in a way that it burns slowly at Weldon Springs. So that's kind of, for me, a reaction from the environment of what needs to be cleansed here, because some of us are sensitive to the energies, the earth is, because I'm feeling a heat. Does anyone else get the heat over here?
Yeah.
But yes, this would be considered a gaping wound on Mother, because you extracted something from her that you were not supposed to utilize in ways that were not honorable, because you're killing and destroying. So this is all part of how we have to try to heal from what we've done and learn better ways to move forward. But, because did you talk, you speak a little bit about the relationship people cannot have with the land because of the toxicity of the area. And it's been really sad. I remember when EPA was started in December 1970, And it does. It seems they are not so much the protectors of the environment they were originally envisioned to be. So there's been a lot of discussion about what is and is not toxic here. They've disavowed a lot of the impact that it's had on the people and the land, and that seems to be in keeping with the corporate paradigm. But that's just my impressions while I'm here.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Some of the conversations, I mean, the landscape, you know, it's easier to articulate forms of democracy in words than it. But this is, you know, when you start to experience forms of democracy that are being articulated by the landscape itself. We talk about homeland, mm-hmm. and I think home was a part of a conversation that people have been having. This role of, you know, we're defending the land. What are we? What does it mean? You know, the Heimat.
Right.
You know, what is the, you know, if we looked at the actual land itself and that relationship as a living expression of our democracies, then how do we translate the writing here, you know, what's happening here into something that, what would those words be? It wouldn't be the words that we write and state without the realities that we walk on and breathe. And
it feels like Mother is exploited and the exploitive industries don't recognize she is a living, breathing being. Mm-hmm. They think it's a thing, an inanimate object that there's no connection or relationship to, which was something that Indigenous people were always about, the relationship and the honoring and being in harmony with whatever the natural environment, because we are nature. We don't have to get back to nature. We are nature. So being more in harmony and alignment with that and recognizing it's not a thing to take from, and that everything that we're talking about disposing of, recycling and repurposing, that being brought into the mindset, because so many things, products that we have these days are about, people have the mindset you can just throw it away. Well, you can't just throw it away.
Well, and Mike talked yesterday about the 42 bridges around St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this all also ends up in those 100-pound catfish if you're not.
Mm-hmm. Catfish. Yes.
You know, he says that, I was talking to him last night, he says, I eat catfish that are between 8 pounds and 15 pounds only.
Yes.
Because they have to be swimming for 2 years.
Right.
They don't sit on the bottom and these chemicals don't absorb in their fat storage.
Right.
So, you know, it's not here where the toxicity is. It's also in
everywhere.
The ground streams that are moving through it and around it, and the species that are landing here and eating and feeding and moving off.
Mm-hmm.
And we sit on a fault line. I mean, all mm-hmm. of the kind of collision of these, the where we are with confluences and the tectonic plates and are also sort of existing on this fissure that is active. Just so I don't forget, if there's a really good movie, well, you can say it's a good movie or not. It's called Atomic Homefront. HBO
mm-hmm.
did a documentary
mm-hmm.
on this situation
on this
and Just Moms a couple of years ago. And it, you can watch this online without much.
There are a couple others, too, for Secret City.
Yeah.
Safe Side of Defense.
Yeah.
Sort of our more grassroots earlier issues.
Right.
But with that, should usher us up the hill, we'll have time to still operate in the space we're establishing here, but at a slightly further remove. We'll have the bus drive up. Lunches are inside, so we'll unload them there. And not to spoil the plot point, but we are now also reaching the spot on our tour where a cash wine bar is available. But if people are going to go that way, I would recommend to streamline the process. Maybe team up with other people and buy a bottle to share. Rather, it's not a high capacity operation we're entering. So the more we can streamline the counter process, the better for everyone. It is not grown on site. But it is a fine Missouri wine, which are of course famous around the world for their quality.
Yeah.